when will the pandemic end? My answer was that the pandemic will end when the world chooses to end it.
The World Health Organization issues warnings. This is Monday, the 2nd of August, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, one small Asian nation seems to be handling the pandemic quite well. Myanmar's military leader says he now leads all government there. Social media for the elderly in China. An overnight rocket attack damages the runway at an Afghanistan airport. And a formal apology from New Zealand to Pacific Islanders. It is all on today's VOA Asia. WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said Friday in Geneva that the global COVID-19 outbreak that is now being driven by the Delta variant of the coronavirus is causing COVID-19 numbers to spike.
Since our last press conference, cases and deaths from COVID-19 have continued to climb. Almost 4 million cases were reported to WHO last week. And on current trends, we expect the total number of cases to pass 200 million within the next 2 weeks. And we know that is an underestimate. On average, in 5 of WHO's 6 regions, infections have increased by 80%, or nearly doubled over the past 4 weeks.
And said Tedros, problems restricting the spread of the pandemic have accumulated, leading to dangerous variants.
So far, 4 variants of concern have emerged, and there will be more as long as the virus continues to spread. The rise is also driven by increased social mixing and mobility, the inconsistent use of public health and social measures, and inequitable vaccine use. Hard-won gains are in jeopardy or being lost, and health systems in many countries are being overwhelmed. The increased number of infections is creating a shortage of treatment, such as life-saving oxygen. 29 countries have high and rising oxygen needs, and many countries have inadequate supplies of basic equipment to protect frontline health workers. Meanwhile, testing rates in low-income countries are less than 2% of what they are in high-income countries, leaving the world blind to understanding where the disease is and how it's changing. Without better testing rates globally, we cannot fight the disease on the front line or mitigate the risk of new, more dangerous variants emerging.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the Delta variant is as contagious as chickenpox and that infections in vaccinated people may be as transmissible as those in the unvaccinated. There is one Asian country that seems to be fighting the virus successfully. That story as we continue on VOA Asia. These are some of the stories you'll find at voanews.com. Thai protesters demand the prime minister resign amid a surge in COVID cases. Malaysia's embattled prime minister postpones a critical parliamentary session set for Monday, citing COVID-19 infections. After months of failed talks, ASEAN is under pressure to name a Myanmar envoy. North Korean leader's sister warns Seoul against a military drill with Washington. South Korea July exports jump to record, though growth pace slows. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the voanews.com website. You're listening to VOA Asia. In the South Asian region that has been devastated by the COVID-19 pandemic, the tiny mountain kingdom of Bhutan stands out as a rare success story. It has reported 2 deaths and about 2,500 cases and vaccinated 90% of its adult population. As Anjana Prasricha reports, even though Bhutan has a small population, health experts say the country has emerged ahead of many nations despite its limited resources.
These helping hands come from Bhutan's so-called orange workforce. They belong to some of about 30,000 citizen volunteers, helping script a rare COVID-19 pandemic success story in the Himalayan country. When the coronavirus hit, authorities offered financial incentives to people to assist its small pool of health personnel and called for volunteers.
And within a very short period of time, the volunteer system got crashed because there were so many people wanting to volunteer. And it was an amazing sort of an experience, you know, to see that here you have incentives, but instead of the incentives, people were actually registering to volunteer, wanting to give something back to the community.
The country of about 750,000 people has now fully vaccinated 90% of adults in an effort propelled by international donors, its leaders, and the community. The first 500,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine came from India. After New Delhi halted exports, Bhutan turned to donors. In July, the COVAX initiative sent Moderna vaccines. Administering 2 different vaccines was never an issue in a country with implicit faith in its constitutional monarch, King Jigme Khesar Namgyel Wangchuk. Neither was vaccine hesitancy.
As a frontliner, I think it's my responsibility to be vaccinated. And also because His Majesty has done so much for us, so we feel it is our responsibility as a citizen.
So people do understand the benefit of vaccine. People do understand that vaccine does prevent diseases, and they have seen it for generations.
The second doses were administered in just a week, even reaching far-flung mountain areas. UNICEF called it the fastest vaccination campaign during the pandemic.
If Bhutan can succeed in a monsoon with so few health workers to get the entire population that's eligible, almost the entire population eligible, vaccinated, and then move to the children, maybe Bhutan can be a beacon of hope in a region that is on fire.
Bhutan's king has trekked to remote hamlets to rally people, especially after the transmissible Delta variant began ravaging India, with which Bhutan has a porous border.
I think if there's lessons to be learned out of Bhutan, it is, of course, the compassionate leadership that has to come from the top. And by compassionate leadership, I mean having deep empathy, really walking in the shoes of others, and then actively making efforts to support people throughout this terrible, terrible pandemic.
Bhutan's success is being attributed to coming together as a nation in a crisis. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Another Asian country is not experiencing the same level of success. That's Australia, where the East Coast states of New South Wales and Queensland are facing an escalating battle against the COVID-19 Delta variant. As Reuters' Jason Albano reports, millions are under strict lockdown, with authorities urging more testing and vaccinations to rein in the outbreaks.
Australia's COVID-19 battle in the states of New South Wales and Queensland worsened on Sunday. That's despite millions being kept under strict lockdown for 5 weeks in its largest city, Sydney. The country on Sunday reported 239 new cases of the highly infectious Delta variant, matching the record set on Thursday. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian urged residents once again to get vaccinated.
Today's the 1st of August, and I'm calling upon the people of Greater Sydney, of Greater New South Wales, to come forward and get vaccinated. To get to the 70% target, we need 9.2 million jabs. To get to the 80% target, we need 10 million jabs. And we've been talking about this in New South Wales for some time.
Australia's vaccination drive has been sluggish, with only 18% of adults fully vaccinated so far. That's owing to a vaccine supply shortage and changing medical advice. The current outbreak, which began in June, has seen cases climb to more than 3,400. Sydney's 5 million residents are now expected to remain under lockdown until at least August 28.
Jason Albano reporting. Happening now in Asia, the U.S. Justice Department announced the seizure of a tanker it said was owned and operated by a Singaporean national and used to make shipments of petroleum products to North Korea in violation of international sanctions. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us on VOA Asia. It is greatly appreciated. Myanmar's ruling state administrative council said Sunday it's become a caretaker government, and its leader, Min Aung Hlaing, is to be prime minister. The announcement came after Min Aung Hlaing on Sunday repeated his pledge to hold multi-party elections at an unspecified future date. More from Reuters' Brian Wood.
Myanmar's military ruler, Min Aung Hlaing, pledged to cooperate with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, to bring an end to the country's violence. He further promised to hold multi-party elections, but did not say when exactly that would happen.
I would like to say that Myanmar is ready to work on ASEAN cooperation within the ASEAN framework, including the dialogue with the ASEAN Special Envoy in Myanmar.
In February, Myanmar's army seized power from a civilian government led by Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi after her ruling party won in disputed elections. The military called the vote fraudulent and branded members of Suu Kyi's party extremists, but the country's electoral commission dismissed the allegation. Military authorities have faced near daily protests since the coup and a resurgence of armed conflicts in the borderlands. One local activist group estimated that armed forces have so far killed more than 900 people, with nearly 7,000 military opponents arrested. ASEAN foreign ministers will meet on Monday as diplomats aim to appoint a special envoy tasked with promoting dialogue between Myanmar's junta and its opponents.
Brian Wood with that.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. With VOA Asia, also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia, the International Olympic Committee does not plan to call for a moment of silence at the Tokyo Games Friday, the anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima in 1945, but does aim to do so at the closing ceremony instead. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia.
This is Business Scene. I'm Josh Nist. 76-year-old Sang Xiaoju is one of an unlikely vanguard of elderly influencers storming Chinese social media with videos of glamour in the golden years. 2 years ago, she joined the Fashion Grandmas, whose one-minute clips and live streams of them turning Beijing streets into a catwalk are viewed by millions of fans. Sang Xiaoju says the fashion grandmas don't focus on how old they are.
I think the elderly should also live the way they want and be optimistic. Don't keep thinking about how old you are. Our fashion grandma group has a slogan, age is just a number.
The collective currently has 23 members with dozens of fringe contributors across the country, all aged between their late 50s and mid-70s. They earn money from pop-up ads in their videos and live streaming product sales. Bian Changyang, CEO of Beijing Dama Technology Company, contributes the pandemic to the elderly's internet success.
Why do we say 2020 is the first year of China's elderly internet industry prosperity? Firstly, it's the first year that the post-60s generation retired, and they are different from the previous elderly group. Second, the pandemic makes them have an urgent need for online activities.
Bian additionally said the pandemic had also pushed the elderly deeper online, hunting for shopping and entertainment. This barber in Pakistan has earned fame within the country and outside of it after he introduced a unique trend of cutting hair, using a cleaver, hammer, and fire, leaving his clients flabbergasted. Ali Abbas has 12 years of experience and has spent 3 years learning the exotic method of cutting hair. While some may be initially scared of the unusual hair cutting style, many prefer the method after giving it a chance. Aruj Badi, one of Abbas's clients, says she enjoys getting her hair cut this way.
I am not scared of it, as now my hair grows more because of the usage of a cleaver rather than scissors. That's why I prefer to have my hair cut with a cleaver. Now I am used to it and I enjoy it a lot.
Abbas says since trying the new method, his client's confidence has been boosted.
Since I started this, my customers have increased. People's confidence has been boosted. When you're visible on a platform and people see you, people will say, we must try this. We should try this.
Abbas charges 2,000 rupees or $13 for the unorthodox treatment and 1,000 rupees for a traditional trim with scissors. For Business Scene, I'm Josh Ness.
Now that you've heard Business Scene, you can see it as well. Just check out our VOA Asia Facebook page. Making headlines in Asia, the National Gallery of Australia will return 14 works of art to India that are suspected of having been stolen, looted, or exported illegally. The religious and cultural artifacts include sculptures, photos, and a scroll, and they're worth around $2.2 million. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, officials in southern Afghanistan confirmed Sunday that an overnight rocket attack by Taliban insurgents damaged the runway at Kandahar Airport, forcing suspension of all flights. The attack occurred during ongoing fierce clashes between Afghan security forces and the Taliban in Kandahar and the adjoining city of Lashkar Gah, the capital of Helmand Province. Thousands of families fled their homes in Afghanistan's eastern Kunar province last week after fighting intensified and the Taliban seized control of two districts. VOA's Zabiullah Ghazi filed this report narrated by Roshan Nurzai.
These families have been living in this makeshift camp in the Asmar district of Kunar province for weeks now. They fled their houses in the Ghaziabad and Nari district as the Taliban began their offensives. Nasreen, a 38-year-old mother who has been living with her children in this tent for the past 2 weeks, says that she spent the Muslim holiday of Eid away from her home.
It was difficult. We did not have new shoes, clothes, and happiness. It was raining and we were displaced.
Provincial officials say that they are trying to provide food and shelter to the displaced people.
We have started our survey today. 4 teams are working and we will have 6 teams working tomorrow.
Officials say that thousands of families left their houses because of the fighting in the province. Local sources say government troops retreated from one district without a fight as the Taliban moved in to take control. Officials have promised to investigate why the Afghan security forces appear to have abandoned their posts.
We are working on it and we will bring them to justice.
Taliban have intensified their attacks in the recent months as the U.S. is completing the withdrawal of its remaining troops from Afghanistan. For Zabiullah Ghazi in Kunar, Afghanistan, this is Roshan Nurzai, VOA News, Washington.
We continue on VOA Asia. New Zealand has formally apologized to the Pacific community, which felt terrorized during police raids searching for visa overstayers in the 1970s. The so-called dawn raids carried out between 1974 and 1976 targeted only people from the Pacific Islands, even though statistics showed the vast majority of overstayers were from Europe and the United States. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has the story.
New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the immigration raids were dehumanising. Speaking at Auckland Town Hall, she expressed her government's sorrow and remorse. She acknowledged the distress and hurt the raids had caused. Many Pacific Islanders moved to New Zealand after World War II to boost a workforce ravaged by conflict overseas. By 1976, they made up just over 2% of the population, or about 65,000 people, according to the national census. As the economy faltered, though, Samoans, Tongans and other Pacific Islanders, who'd arrived as desperately needed migrant workers, were suddenly accused of taking jobs away from New Zealanders. That prompted a crackdown by the police on those suspected of overstaying their visas. Churches, schools and workplaces were routinely raided, as were homes, often in the middle of the night. New Zealand's Minister for Pacific Peoples, Aupito Williams-Seo, recalled when his family was targeted.
To have somebody knocking at the door in the early hours of the morning with a flashlight in your face, disrespecting the owner of the home, with an Alsatian dog frothing at the mouth in that door and wanting to come in without any respect for the people living in there, is quite traumatised. I've had sisters said, oh my goodness, I never even want to think about that. That's just my family. That's replicated across the Pacific community.
Thousands of people were arrested and deported, and many have recalled their humiliation and pain. Both major political parties in New Zealand have accepted that the raids were racist. British and American visitors, who made up about 40% of overstayers at the time, were rarely targeted by the authorities. New Zealand governments rarely make formal apologies for past injustices. Ardern also announced that education scholarships would be provided to Pacific communities in New Zealand, including those from Samoa, the Cook Islands, Fiji and Kiribati. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
We continue on VOA Asia. Fake videos generated by artificial intelligence, also known as deepfakes, are becoming more common and harder to detect. But some deepfakes are being used for a good cause. Karina Bafrazian has the story.
These are deepfake videos. Here is Donald Trump confessing to being racist. And here is Tom Cruise, equipped with a mop and a bucket, cleaning the kitchen. According to the cybersecurity company, Sensity, videos like these are becoming more common, more intricate and harder to detect. In a report, Sensity says 90% of deepfakes target women, with fake naked photos and videos on the internet. Women's rights activist Noelle Martin found fake sexual videos purporting to show her had racked up thousands of views. The authors of the fakes were never identified, but the situation led Martin to start a campaign helping women who found themselves in a similar situation.
It's very easy to say to people, like, just be private. Just be careful what you post online, like, don't post online or don't have a social media account. And I just don't believe that that's a good enough stance for 2021.
Martin wants governments to regulate deepfakes online. Recently, so-called geographical deepfakes have become a large concern as well. There are fake satellite images that can, for instance, be used as a disinformation tool to spread fake information about natural disasters. Not all deepfakes are dangerous in themselves. A startup called Flawless has introduced a program for dubbing foreign movies and TV shows while syncing the actor's lips and the sound. The algorithm analyzes the facial expressions of the actor or actress, then does the same with the dubbing actor and then syncs the two.
If you break down the language barriers, I think that like there's a real amazing opportunity for people to start to sort of access more content from around the world, where I think previously probably the dubbing and subtitling barrier would probably prevented a lot of people from wanting to watch it.
The developers believe the technology in this case can take the movie industry to a whole new level and become an example of a good and effective way to use deepfakes. Karina Befragin for VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter, at VOA Asia. And you can find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, Amy Heibels, Chris Cascayo, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman. Stay safe. Enjoy the day ahead.